Just to review for one moment and also to either refresh your memories or for those who weren't here last time, we started out by saying that most people, when they think of Agadata, stories in the Gemara about the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, they think specifically of Kamsa Bar Kamsa. And also, most people, when they think about the reasons behind the destruction, they think of Sinat Chinam. But we are going to look at a number of Agadata, a number of stories that are linked together. They're all found in Masechet Gittin. And we're going to look at how they're connected to one another and what the reasons behind those stories or what the message that emerges from those stories about why the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, what caused it, what we can learn from it, come from the stories. And I mentioned, interestingly enough, the words Sinat Chinam do not appear. They do appear in the Gemara elsewhere, and we'll talk about that in our final class next week. And how? Oh, in 2 weeks. Thank you. Tisha B'Av will be in between, so I guess there'll be a cliffhanger during Tisha B'Av. But we'll talk about that in our final class of why Sinat Chinam became linked with Kamsa Bar Kamsa and became the only lasting reason that is given for the destruction.
Can you repeat what
Kamsa
means?
Kamsa, it's the name of a person, and it means locusts. So we said that symbolically, the name Kamsa is telling us that something extremely small but destructive is about to occur. The snowball destructive effect. So I think when we last left off, we were talking about the word anvatnut, humility, and speaking of the irony in this story, that normally that term is used in such a positive way to describe the greatest character traits. Moshe Rabbeinu is the greatest anav in history. And here is the one example in which it's used in a negative context to mean meekness or wimpiness, almost. So, why so? First of all, I wanted to point out that normally many rabbinic stories, many Agadata in the Gemara, take place within the walls of the Beit Midrash. And what would you say characterizes the environment of the Beit Midrash? You know, I've noticed in my years of learning in a Beit Midrash, this is a class mostly to women, we have a couple of men here, but I've noticed that female Beit Midrash shot tend to look a little different than male Beit Midrashim. So, Machloket, argument. So, I used to discuss this with my husband that, like, the YU Beis Midrash, not that I'm really there often, is a very loud place. It becomes almost like white noise. And people are debating and arguing and getting excited. And hopefully it's changed since I've been there, but about 10 years ago when I was in the Stern Beit Midrash a lot, it was a more tame, quiet place. I was probably the loudest one there. I remember a few years after I had been learning there, I hosted someone, like an advisor on a Shabbaton, slept at my house, and when she came in, she goes, "Oh my gosh, I know your voice." And she was in Stern undergrad when I was in GPATS, the graduate program in advanced Talmud in Stern, and I guess I was loud, so she knew my voice from the Beit Midrash. But most Beit Midrashes tend to be places that are loud, there's a lot of debate, there's a lot of conflict, and therefore there are a number of stories where the message of the story is the call for humility, the need for humility. You have first of all, a number of times where it says there was always the debates between Hillel and Shammai, and because Hillel was an Anav, that's why the Gemara says, that's why we paskin like Hillel. Similarly, you have the famous story of Rabbi Eliezer and the Bat Kol. It's really Tanor Shel Achnai, the oven of Achnai, where Rabbi Eliezer was debating the other Chachamim. And if you really understand and analyze that story, it also is about the need for humility, the need for people reducing argument, reducing machloket. However, our story does not take place within the walls of the Beit Midrash. It takes place in the larger world. And when it comes to politics, you need decisive action. So the good quality of humility sometimes is not called for, and it turns into a bad quality and is now called meekness. Because when it comes to the political world, you need decisive action. All right, that's just summing up. That was the end of part three. We're on page 5 of the source packet. I wanted to make one other point from last week that I noticed. If you remember, we were discussing Rabbi Zachariah and how he discouraged the Chachamim from taking action when they were brought the korban with a mum, a korban with a blemish. And there were two possible actions the Chachamim were considering. Who remembers what they were? What were the two things the Chachamim were thinking about doing with the korban? They were thinking of bringing the korban anyway, despite it having a mum. And the reason Rabbi Zachariah didn't want them to was less people say that they brought an animal with a mum. So we emphasized greatly the fact that it says Yomru, that they would less people perceive it the wrong way and say that we allowed a korban with a mum. What was the other action they were contemplating? Killing Bar Kamsa. And what's interesting is we as a group last class were very uncomfortable with that option. We related much more to Rabbi Zachariah's rejection of taking that extreme action, because obviously it involves death. So another little translation note is, I mentioned last time, I used the Sansino translation, but it's not 100% accurate in each case. If you look at the top of page 5, when they propose to kill Bar Kamsa so that he should not go and inform against them, but Rabbi Zachariah said to them, is one who makes a blemish on consecrated animals to be put to death? In the translation, it looks as if Rabbi Zachariah simply is rejecting the possibility of killing Bar Kamsa because it is wrong and it is a sin for which you are put to death.
We're talking about Masira over here.
What do you mean?
Masira means to inform against them.
Right.
Which means death is perfectly allowed.
Okay, that's a good argument, and maybe that's why, if you look at the actual Hebrew, they have twisted Rabbi.
He didn't know, he hadn't done it yet.
Who hadn't? Bar Kamsa? Well, he had gone to the Romans and tried.
But now,
I will go and inform against you.
Right. He already went to the Romans and said, the Jews are rebelling, let me prove it to you, send a korban and they won't sacrifice it. But anyway, the simple point I wanted to make is, when you look at the Hebrew, it says, Rabbi Zachariah, Yomru Meitil Mum Bekodshim Yahareg. Wait a minute, did I... is one who makes a blemish on... Yeah. So the translation leaves out the word Yomru. That again, it makes it look like Bar Kamsa, that his art, the translation makes it look like Bar Kamsa doesn't deserve death, therefore we shouldn't kill him. When you look at the Hebrew, it's a slight nuance, but it's important. It shows you that what his concern was wasn't that Bar Kamsa wasn't deserving of death. His concern was, what will people say? They will say that Bar Kamsa wasn't deserving of death. So again, I just wanted to point out that what we saw from that story of part two was a fear of what people will think, not a fear of killing Bar Kamsa or a fear of bringing the korban because it's actually wrong, a fear of not acting, not doing it because of what people might say about it, the perception that it was wrong. And that's what caused the rabbis to be inactive. It's an important distinction only because if they truly believed the action itself were wrong, we would be more sympathetic to the argument of the rabbis. It's because their fear is more about perception that this story is more critical. Hopefully you caught that. All right, let's move on to part four. We're on page five, part four. This is the section of the emperor sending Nero. What did you notice about this? What does Nero do before actually attacking? Okay, the arrow shooting thing. What's going on there? What's going on with the arrow? First of all, why does Nero shoot the arrows, and what do the arrows tell him?
Don't you shoot arrows up to test the wind, the direction of the wind?
Okay, and yet in this case, he shoots four arrows, and they all land in the same place. So what clearly is happening? It's not simply the direction of the wind. He's getting a very clear message. It's like Nero shooting arrows is essentially looking for an oath, looking for a sign. Am I really supposed to be destroying Yerushalayim? And if you were interpreting this sign, the answer is
yes.
Every arrow he shoots, no matter what direction he shoots it in, lands directly in Yerushalayim. A very clear, an unambiguous sign of what to do. But he is extremely cautious, like the rabbis, by the way, extremely cautious. So what is the next thing he does? After he's seen his sign, he inquires of a young child wanting to know the last pasuk that this child learned. What is the last verse you learned? So he's extremely cautious. And what happens with the pasuk that the child quotes him? Is it a sign that he's meant to destroy Yerushalayim or not?
Yeah.
Yes, it is. It is a further confirmation that he is meant to destroy Yerushalayim. So what upsets him about it? Why doesn't he want to after that? Exactly. Because now, once he sees this pasuk, Nero finds himself in a catch-22. He is intended to destroy Yerushalayim. God wants him to destroy Yerushalayim. But ultimately, God is going to be against the Romans. God is going to be against the emperor. And clearly, God would be against him if it's carried out through him, if the destruction is carried out through him. He really doesn't want to be a puppet in this play. He doesn't want to be the one to carry out God's will and later have Hashem turn against him. So, similar to the rabbis in the story right before this, he's in this very difficult position. So far, we've seen three stories, each one where, like, it's unclear what to do, and it keeps getting more difficult. The first story was Bar Kamsa's house. Should the rabbis maybe get up and leave? Not Bar Kamsa's house, the party thrower's house. But should the rabbis get up and leave with Bar Kamsa or not? The next was a much more difficult decision. The next decision they had to make was, should they sacrifice this animal or should they kill Bar Kamsa or not? Now Nero has, it almost seems like he doesn't have a choice. It almost seems like there is no decision to make. However, even though Nero seems to be in a more difficult position than the rabbis, he gets out of it. He finds a way out of it. He runs away, and he becomes a convert. And lo and behold, Rabbi Meir is his descendant. So, first of all, when you have a descendant that is so praiseworthy, it definitely reminds us of the story of Ruth, of when you convert and you do something extraordinary and you show true allegiance to Hashem, you are granted good progeny. I don't know. I first of all, I want to give credit now. This is a nice point to do so, that many of the ideas I got came from a wonderful book by Professor Jeffrey Rubinstein, in where he analyzes rabbinic stories. And so he also does a lot of... Yes? Well, I was about to say this. It seems unlikely that this is a historical part of the story. There's no other mention of it anywhere else, at least. And I don't think there's any evidence that Rabbi Meir was a descendant of a convert. None that I found. So, but it's making a point. He's obviously coming. He's brought in as a foil to the rabbis that, like, you know...
Was he acted justly while the others did not?
I don't know justly, but he acted. That he was able to find a way out when the rabbis were not. Where I will say that another point of comparison is a very obvious thing he does that the rabbis do not do is that he goes to the Torah. And he not only looks for an oat, but he looks for a pasuk in the Torah to guide him. A pagan goy at the time does that, where when the rabbis were contemplating the korban, at least in this story, there's no quoting of psukim, there's not even a halachic analysis. So... Huh?
It's interesting that his action is non-action. He decides not to attack, whereas their action before was non-action. They didn't leave. They didn't serve the different responsibilities. Maybe.
Well, I see why you see it as non-action, although it's a little more than non-action because he runs off, joins Jews, and converts and becomes a practicing Jew. So it's non-action from what he was expected to do. But the point is that he was able to break expectations. And it like we said, it almost looked as if he didn't have a choice. And in his case, taking non-action... See, had he really just done nothing and remained the same, he clearly would have been killed by the Roman emperor. So he had to be creative and find a way out and change his circumstances. So his result, the result of his choice is Rabbi Meir descending from him. The result of the rabbis choice or non-choice, let's say, is the eventual destruction. Okay, so let's go on to part five. So finally, after Nero runs away, they send Vespasian, and he besieges Jerusalem for 3 years. And then we have these three men who are providing food for the city. What's interesting about this story of the three men? I mean, there are many things. So relating to the criticism we've begun building, how does it relate to what we've been criticizing the rabbis for?
Very active.
Who is?
These Nechdimo and Kaba Sevua.
These three men are very active.
Right.
These three men, but where are the rabbis? Where is the rabbinic leadership?
These were very rich people, right? Nechdimo, but I mean, I just remember like storybooks from
They were
Birim.
Right. These were the wealthy men who were providing. But you have the rabbis mentioned only in terms of which is sort of the best way to store the food, which is the best wealth. The only mention of them really relates to eating the food, but not changing or helping the situation. You know, the leadership of the city, even if they don't have the funds to provide, they have the ability to inspire, organize, help distribute, whatever it is, but we don't see them acting in that way right here. It's unclear if there was political leadership outside of the rabbis at that time. Through these stories, we see that they were functioning. I mean, they're the Romans, obviously, but, you know. Kohanim, but the leaders at that time seemed to float between the rabbis and the Bar Yonai, as we're going to see. Yeah?
I kind of see this as being an appropriate reaction of the rabbis to not step up and try and change everything, but rather just to guide what the people are doing, because I don't remember if we learned with you last time, that the rabbis knew what was happening. They knew that the Beit HaMikdash was going to be destroyed. So, therefore, their lack of action may be the appropriate response. Since they knew what was going on, they're going to give everybody false hope and try and come up with solutions.
Well, there are a couple of things. First of all, it's always an interesting question when something is written in stone and when there's still a chance to change, and also how severe a devastation is going to hit. So even if you could say it's inevitable at some point the Beis HaMikdash is going to be destroyed, is it inevitable the complete destruction of Yerushalayim, the starvation of the people, the desolation that we see happen? And according to the Nevi'im, yes, but I don't know. It's unclear whether they're also, one other thing I have to say, this is being written years after. So whenever you have a crisis in history, during it and immediately after it, you wouldn't find it productive necessarily to write then and there, point fingers. But the rabbinic way is to then look back at history and learn lessons from it. So we can't necessarily let's say that you're right on a very literal level, that there was nothing more they could have done. But now, looking back, we want to learn lessons from history, and they want to learn lessons. And I don't think I mentioned this point before, but one of the greatest things about Agadata is whenever you read any Agadita, so many of them are self-critiques by Chachamim, by the rabbis, which is an amazing ability that to, when you're going to learn lessons and when you're going to teach, to start with yourself. So there isn't a fear of critiquing themselves. There's an embracing of that, and that's clearly going on in these stories.
You just reminded me, I remember learning that post-World War II, in the Holocaust, there is a criticism that is lodged against the Rebbeim.
Uh-huh.
Right?
Yeah.
Where they knew what was going on, or they could perceive, and they told their people not to leave.
Right.
Interesting.
Right.
If they knew this.
It is interesting.
Very little of that is true.
Yeah, and also, I think that on some level, right now we're still too close to it. Most of us still have a visceral reaction against affixing blame internally when it comes to the Holocaust, I think it's still too close to home and too close in history to look at it quite in that way, except the obvious. I mean, obviously, you know, the persecutors we affix blame to, but yeah.
The rabbi is mentioned in part 5. They make a judgment that the wood is the donation of the wood.
Correct.
When you store wheat, you don't need heat to store wheat. You want a cool environment.
Well,
something is different in the desert for storing wheat.
I cannot help you with. I don't know anything about storing wheat. Well, you know what? There is a judgment on which food is better. That's true. Which way of storage is better. Okay, let's move on to part 6. We were saying before, the Bar Yonai were in the city. So, first of all, due to inaction, the Bar Yonai have gained a lot of power, but obviously the Bar Yonai have not been able to push the people to completely fight against the Romans, which shows that there really are two groups of leaders in charge. The rabbis still have some sway over the people. The fact, you know, because the Bar Yonai have not accomplished their goals, but the Bar Yonai are also getting in the way of the rabbis and have obviously gained power as well.
I'm sorry, who are the Bar Yonai?
So, I translated it as thugs. They're obviously a negative force described at this time period, a group of extremists, zealots, thugs, different people translate it differently, who very much wanted to fight against the Romans, not compromise with them.
Does the Bar, the son of anything? Is that
a... I don't think it has an actual meaning, although what is interesting, if you just look at the letters, is it has very similar lettering to Rabbanan. So it's almost like the anti-Rabbanan are the Bar Yonai. And similarly, when you think of how they are different from the Rabbanan, they are the opposite of Anvatnut. They are not humble or meek at all. They believe in using force. So they, of course, burn the stores of wheat, and they cause a famine. Yeah.
I think the rabbis weren't proactive. It's to go out and make pieces of music.
They wanted to, but they can't do it.
I understand that, but in this case, they weren't passive. They had a point of view.
I agree that they have a point of view. I think the question is, why were they not successful in pushing their point of view, in throwing out the Bar Yonai, in doing something to make it happen? Yeah, but I think the point, one of the points that we have been seeing throughout all these stories is sometimes you really got to be strong and do something. That this is a desperate time that's going to call for that. Well, first of all, we're going to see that by part eight, another solution without a civil war. Rabbi Yochanan sneaks out, and that's one other solution. But it takes over 3 years, 3 to 4 years, before anything like that is done. And the devastation has reached an all-time low by that point. Yeah?
The rabbi's response is a very negative one. Don't fight because you're not going to win. If half the battles in the world were chosen that way, things would have been very different with a lot of events.
That's true, but there is a time that calls for a reality check. I don't know your name, but like you said before, they could have known this was a losing battle. Let's save as many people. Let's save as much as we can. Why see our city in ruins? If we give in, we'll be able to save the city and save the people. Yeah.
It kind of seems like it's the commentary on them here is too little, too late. Like they're asking, you know, we've already lost war, everything's kind of over. Just let us go make peace. I'm like,
right.
Kind of in the theme that you were saying, at this point, you know, they don't deserve in a more metaphysical sense to, you know, take action because they've been passive for so long.
Or they're not successful with.
Yeah.
Winning greater than they do, yeah. And I think I want to point out, I mentioned this in the beginning, this is a group of stories that's going to have one perspective on what went wrong. It's not the only perspective. So, and we'll get to that next time. Where does Sinat Chinam come from, and why was that the more lasting perspective? But I definitely think there is a voice of critique against inaction running through these stories. You, although feel free to differ. Part seven, we have the story of Marta. This story really shows the severity of the famine and the urgency of the situation. If you remember from the first class, one theme that we said kept repeating had to do with being sent. How do we see that here?
She sends
her servant 3 or 4 times. And again, it's like, it's the servant who fails. He's given a very simple task to get food, and he keeps failing because he has this inability to act, because he lacks the self-confidence to make the decision. And on a literary level, I think the servant can also be seen as showing something about the rabbis also, who for a while lack the confidence or the push to make a decision and to act.
But as a servant, I can see you have a very demanding mistress. She wants fine flour and it comes home with coarse flour, he may get severely punished. So I don't see the venue around the servant. I don't think it's in his role to necessarily.
Well, maybe, but it really seems here, due to what happens, due to that she dies of starvation, it seems that it was a severe situation.
There is a repeated literary reference to by the time.
Right.
By the time he got around to it. So it kind of puts the onus on
him. Right, right. Now, I mentioned that some of these stories appear in other places, like Eicha Rabbah, and this is one of them. And the one part that is different is the line in the middle about Rabbi Yochanan. Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai applied to her the verse, "The tender and delicate woman among you, which would not adventure to set the sole of her foot upon the ground." So he doesn't appear in the other version. He may have been put in here to quote this pasuk, because we know he is about to appear in the next story. He is about to become our hero. And this is the story that reaches the low of the lows. Like I said, this is the lowest point in the desolation and the starvation of the people, that I think is the push for the rabbis that they have to act now before everything is lost. If even the wealthiest woman is now falling prey to starvation, it is clearly a very severe situation.
What is the symbolism of her taking her shoes off?
That's a good question. She asked, what's the symbolism with Marta taking off her shoes? I would say, I didn't think about it before, although I don't know why I didn't, but there's a certain amount of laziness, according to that version of the story, that causes her to die. It's like, oh, I already took off my shoes. I'm too lazy to put them back on. I'll just go out barefoot. And really, that was a mistake, you know? And we've been seeing here, like, an exhaustion or a, you know, it could be connected to the lack of acting.
Lack of food, lack of energy.
Right, lack of energy, lack of food, lack of action. She had taken them off, and she doesn't want to bother putting them back on. And she had never gone outside without her shoes before. Or it's people who aren't used to. I think the other idea with the shoes is the story begins. This whole series of story begins with lavish. Remember, the first class mentioned wealth is a major theme here. The whole story begins with an abundance of wealth, an abundance of food, an abundance of lavishness with the banquet. And here is a person who cannot adapt to her new situation. She's used to a certain lifestyle, and she can't be one of these people who goes out barefoot. She can't adjust to that.
In a lot of ways, that she spoils the Bar Kamsa story, and that, like, at the end, he's trying to pay for everything and using all of his money to save himself from this, you know, embarrassment. And she
right.
ends the story, you know, throwing all her money in the streets and also can't save herself.
Right, completely. There is all the money, all the food, everything is present. Here, it's like the opposite, and a woman humiliating herself, because this, to her, would be her humiliation of having to go out of her rich home into the streets with the starvation. Absolutely. What's also interesting is the second version of how she dies with the figs. So Rabbi Tzadok had been fasting for 40 years to try to conquer the destruction, because he was afraid of the destruction of Yerushalayim, and the figs used to revive him. Now it's those same figs that revive him that kill Marta. It's just, everything's flipped on its head. It also shows that maybe there are times when devotion, tehillim, prayer aren't enough. You need that, plus you need action. So the rabbis were aware of the impending doom, but they didn't handle it from a they didn't address it from a political standpoint, at least until now. And like I said, this is sort of the turning point in our story, right before Rabbi Yochanan acts, when he realizes how severe the situation is. And so the figs bring everything round circle, you know, make everything full circle. That those are the figs which highlighted what the approach the rabbis were trying to take, and this story shows that approach is now failing. You need a new approach. You need to try something different. Okay. So we're up to part 8. Part 8 also brings the Bar Kamsa story full circle, because Bar Kamsa was desperately trying to stay in the party and was being forced out. And here, the rabbis desperately want to get out of the walls of Yerushalayim, and they are being forced in, being forced to stay by the Bar Yonai. So there is, it is kind of the opposite here. And again, like you mentioned before, that Bar Kamsa wanted to stay in the party with plenty of food. The rabbis want to leave the city of starvation. So Abba Sikra and Rabbi Yochanan come up with a plan. And what's really great is the plan is certainly flawed, as you mentioned. They're not going to be able to save everyone. They're not going to be able to save all of Yerushalayim or the Beit HaMikdash. But at least they finally are taking action. And that's why it's, I think that this story appears in a positive light. There's also a lot of symbolism at the end. Let's look at the underlined Hebrew. The underlined Hebrew in part 8, what is it supposed to remind you of that we saw earlier? Exactly. It's supposed to remind you of Rabbi Zechariah's statements in part 2. That he was a Rabbi Zechariah, the phrase Yomru, they will say, what will, remember Rabbi Zechariah, what will the people say that we sacrificed an animal with a moon? What will the people say? They know that Bar Kamsa, just for informing on us, is not deserving of death. So here too, Abba Sikra is throwing that back in the Bar Yonai's face. What will they say that you have pierced through your master, this great rabbi, and or that you have pushed him, and therefore the Bar Yonai let them out. So here we see the story is taking a good turn, because the rabbis, instead of falling prey to the argument of what will people say, and giving into that, they're now using that against the Bar Yonai successfully. So by them taking decisive action, by the rabbis, or Rabbi Yochanan in particular, coming up with a plan, taking decisive action, putting it into play, even if it is a slightly flawed plan, they have turned the tables. They have now been the ones, they have made the Bar Yonai, who were before the actors, into the people who are afraid of what people will say. So finally, the rabbis have taken the main active role, and we will not see the Bar Yonai again after this point. They have assumed power and responsibility and action again in part 8. All right, do we have a couple more minutes? We'll do part 9. Is everyone still following? Okay. So he comes and he says, and he greets the king, Shlama Alecha Malka, Shlama Alecha Malka. And he is also finally beginning to quote Psukim in this story. But what happens in this story? What happens when he greets the king? Or I shouldn't say king. It's really Vespasian, and that's the issue of contention. Okay. So he throws two questions back at Rabbi Yochanan. Number one, I'm not a king, so why are you calling me one? And number two, why did you not come to me before now? Which question does Rabbi Yochanan have an answer for? Which question does he not? Who said that?
He answered the second first and only later.
Okay. Well, he answers the first question. He says, you are going to be a king. And the second one is the one he doesn't really answer. Sorry, he doesn't answer sufficiently. What happens? As for your question, why, if you are king, I did not come to you until now, the answer is that the Bar Yonai among us did not let me. He said to him, Vespasian said to him, is there a jar of honey round which a serpent is wound? Would they not break the jar to get rid of the serpent? Meaning, what was Vespasian implying?
Why don't they take control of the Bar
Yonai? Yeah.
Try anyway.
Do it anyway. Make it happen. Which is essentially what our question was about the rabbis all along. Why didn't they make it happen? So here, Vespasian is really he's being used as the voice of critique. He's showing us what the rabbis are guilty of, or if the word guilty is too strong, what the rabbis could have done or should have done.
It looks like he's criticizing the Bar Yonai. He's saying like they should have done that sooner because the reason he hadn't gone out is that they hadn't let him go out until that point. They had to wait until they were really starving until obviously they're letting him out.
First of all, of course it's criticizing the Bar Yonai. There's no question they're not looked at favorably. Well, then why do we allow Vespasian to stump him? Because after he says that thing about the Bar Yonai, Vespasian answers, is there a jar of honey round which a serpent is wound? Would they not break the jar to get rid of the serpent? He could give no answer.
No, but I don't think that's criticizing the Bar Yonai. And he said, yeah, I agree with you. I don't know what their story is. Meaning
the serpent is growing and the jar is. I think.
Yeah, well, the classic rabbi should have taken space.
Well,
I think
we should have
taken space.
Given it the last
time, the jar is for space here. The comment that space here. So why didn't you reach the jar, the space here? And who's the serpent? The Bar Yonai was.
Right. I think breaking the jar, Vespasian's almost saying, you know, so it's unclear what he means by break the jar, meaning break Yerushalayim, break the walls down? Could be. But I think how you know it's a critique is that they leave Rabbi Yochanan with nothing to say, and it's someone else who later says, Rabbi Yosef, or some people say Rabbi Akiva, said, God turns wise men backwards and make their knowledge foolish. That is a clear way, a clear judgment, saying it's not just Rabbi Yochanan didn't respond because, oh, I agree with you, so I'm not going to respond. No, he had no response. It's like he was made to be foolish in that moment. Not that he is foolish, but he was left being foolish because he didn't have a good answer. Exactly. And even that, though, what is Rabbi Akiva really says what he should have done? We take a pair of tongs and grip the snake and kill it and leave the jar intact. In other words, we take the Bar Yonai, or we take Bar Kamsa, we take the force that is destroying us inwardly, and we kill it and we remove it, and we therefore save the people from the starvation, or we therefore save whatever's left of the city. But that's not what we did. And perhaps Rabbi Yochanan didn't answer what Rabbi Akiva suggests because he knew he didn't do that. Maybe because he was stumped, or maybe because what's the point of changing the metaphor if you didn't do what the change is either? So I do think there is somewhat a critique of Rabbi Yochanan. He's viewed here as a flawed hero. He's clearly doing the right thing now. He's clearly correct in acting now and saving what he could, but more could have been done and more should have been done.
Wouldn't you say that the May 4th was where it started with that first group of rabbis who didn't pull out, who didn't leave, who didn't say anything?
Absolutely. But you could say there are two messages here. One is that the rabbis didn't take a strong enough leadership role, and that could be with moral leadership, as in the Bar Kamsa situation, and political leadership. But I would say both. You know, there, and we all know there are leaders who are more, when it comes to rabbinic figures. Should they extend their authority or their power beyond the shul, beyond the Beit Midrash, to moral issues, to political issues? It's not always a clear-cut answer. And even here, I think looking back, it's easy to critique it. It wasn't clear-cut to them at the time. You're right that the Bar Kamsa issue is the most clear-cut. That's the most obvious case where you say they should have walked out. It obviously was wrong not to. You know, and that's the progression of the story. Each time they have to make a decision, the decision gets harder. I think we have to end here because there's lunch. I'll just say we have very little of the story left, just the ending. So hopefully next class we'll finish the story and talk about where Sinat Chinam appears, why it doesn't, you know, why it sort of took over as the overriding message about the destruction when it doesn't appear here. Thank you very much.
How many years after